This is CME on ReachMD. This activity, titled Primary Care's Skin in the Game, Psoriasis Identification, Treatment, and Referral Decisions, is brought to you by the France Foundation and supported by an educational grant from Novartis. Before beginning this activity, please be sure to review the faculty and commercial support disclosure statements, as well as the learning objectives. Here is your host, Dr. Shira Johnson.
When it comes to mild to moderate psoriasis, the role of the primary care clinicians is continually expanding. In fact, one quarter of patients seek psoriasis care from primary care physicians. And while it's not uncommon for PCPs to evaluate and manage a variety of dermatologic issues, knowledge gaps unfortunately still remain. So how can we better address these gaps to optimize patient care? Welcome to CME on ReachMD. I'm Dr. Shira Johnson, and joining me are Dr. Paul Dogramji, family physician and member of the American Academy of Family Physicians, and Dr. Abby Van Voorhees, chair of dermatology at the Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. Today we'll be discussing the role of the family physician in the diagnosis and management of psoriasis. Dr. Dogramji, Dr. Van Voorhees, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So to start us off, Paul, can you tell us what psoriasis looks like and where it's typically located?
So psoriasis is an immune-mediated disease with genetic predisposition. No distinct immunogen has been identified, so it really has to do with looking at the skin. And there really are five forms of them, all showing three things: erythema, or itchiness, and scaliness. Now, the most common is plaque psoriasis, and we primary care doctors have seen this. It's about 90% of the affected patients with psoriasis have plaque psoriasis, characterized by well-defined round or oval plaques that differ in size, and often they coalesce. They occur typically on the extensor surfaces of the arms and legs, like the elbows and knees, but they can also occur in the scalp, the buttock, and the trunk. Now, there's another one which is called inverse psoriasis, which is less scaly than plaque form and occurs in the skin fold, so it can be a bit confusing. Like the flexor surfaces of the and the perineal area, they're the inframammary areas, the axillary areas, the inguinal areas, intergluteal areas. Some heat and trauma and infection may contribute to their development or coming out. The third form is called erythrodermic psoriasis, which is characterized by widespread generalized redness or erythema, and it's often associated with systemic symptoms. It may develop slowly from long-standing psoriasis, or it can appear just abruptly by itself as an initial case with psoriasis. A fourth form is called pustular psoriasis, and this can sometimes be confusing as well. It consists of pustules on the palms and of the soles that have nice distinct borders at times, and there's no plaque psoriasis associated. It can be confusing. And the final one is guttate psoriasis, and it's more common in patients that are younger than 30 years of age. And these lesions are usually located on the trunk, accounting for a very small percentage, about 2% of psoriatic cases. The classical findings are 1 to 10 millimeter pink papules with fine scaling. And interestingly, a lot of times this can come out after a bout of group A strep infection in a young adult. So those are the five main forms, again, the most common being plaque psoriasis.
Dr. Van Voorhees, would you like to comment on psoriatic arthritis?
Sure. Well, psoriatic arthritis occurs pretty commonly in those with psoriasis. About 30%, we estimate, of patients who develop skin disease, psoriasis, will ultimately go on to have psoriatic arthritis. In fact, it's the most common concurrent illness that occurs in those with psoriasis. Usually, the psoriasis develops first. So people present with their skin disease, and they will often have it for, on average, 10 to 15 years before they develop that joint disease. Now, that's not always the case. About 10% of patients can develop both the skin disease and the joint disease at the same time. And then, rarely, about 5% of patients will develop the joint disease first before they develop the skin disease. This last form, where the joint disease occurs first, is the trickiest form, because many of the criteria we use, we call it the Casper criteria, to diagnose psoriatic arthritis are based on the presence of skin disease and or a family history of that skin disease. So you can see where it makes it much more challenging to get that diagnosis of psoriatic arthritis if the skin disease is not present, or at least has a patient have a history of having had it previously. But it is quite a common concurrent illness with psoriasis. psoriatic arthritis itself can be a little tricky to diagnose. It can occur, usually it occurs where just one single joint will get swollen or inflamed, but it can look a lot like rheumatoid arthritis. So you can have bilateral symmetric joint involvement as well. So it can be a tricky diagnosis to come forward with, even for people who are experts in the field.
Now, as I understand it, Paul, you actually have a patient case to share with us. What can you tell us about this patient?
Here's a 32-year-old gentleman who comes to see me. He presents with these things on his elbows, on his scalp. I'm going to call them plaques because that's what they look like when he presents with. Again, they're on the elbows and on their scalp. The lesions have persisted for about 6 months or so. They're itchy, they're scaly, they're red, they're bothersome to him. And he thinks that it could be psoriasis because his father also had the same thing. And he comes in saying, what do I have and what do I want to do about it? This is a case that none of us should miss.
Thanks for sharing that with us. What are some clues, though, that would lead you to suspect this diagnosis? And I know it can be confused with many other differentials.
Well, I think the key feature is the pattern of involvement. So, as you heard, this patient has involvement of his elbows and his scalp, and those are two of the most common locations for psoriasis to occur. And they've been persistent for a long period of time, in this case, 6 months. So that also is quite characteristic of psoriasis. And the fact that they are, you know, uncomfortable. Generally, patients with psoriasis talk about their lesions as being either itchy or painful and tender, and this patient reports all of those things. You know, things that you'd have to think about. I mean, it's not the only diagnosis it could be. Occasionally, even on the elbows, patients with eczema can present that way, and often physicians are tricked by that, you know, thinking everything on the elbows has to be psoriasis. But in fact, you know, eczema sometimes can occur there as well. That's probably the thing that's most commonly confused.
So, Paul, now that this patient's been diagnosed, what is the recommended treatment approach, and how do you decide what to start with?
Yeah, well, this is a mild case of psoriasis, and it's affecting less than 5% of the total body. So the current recommendation would be to use topical, but really it's going to be a topical corticosteroid. And I would use a super potent one, like a class 1 topical steroid for the elbows and maybe even for the scalp. And if he had it anywhere else, like the face and some of the body folds, I might use a low potency or a class 6 or 7 one. Now, regarding the vehicles, you know, this gets a little bit maybe individualized in a sense where I would ask the patient, what do you like, what do you prefer? But generally, you know, for the scalp, they're going to do well with a gel or a foam because it goes in and it's not messy and it kind of disappears pretty nicely. And when it comes to, you know, young adults like this, they don't really like oily ointments and things. So creams may be a good idea to use. So generally, again, a topical steroid, a pretty potent one for the areas involved, and probably using a gel for the scalp and maybe using a cream for the elbows.
So would you like to comment a little more, Abby, about the Psoriasis Foundation and their treat-to-target goals?
Yeah, I think in the last, you know, decade or so, as treatments have improved, our ability to bring it into the suffering of patients with psoriasis has also commensurately improved. What the goals say are that patients should get to the point of being clear or almost clear after 3 or certainly after 6 months of a given treatment. So, you know, as Paul was just saying, in that patient where you're using a very strong topical steroid, you know, on their elbows and in their scalp, you know, we'd expect that those areas really would go to the point where the lesions resolved and the patient would be able to change the administration of those class 1 steroids to maybe on an as-needed basis or, you know, or at least not using it twice daily every day. So the goal is to get patients really to the point where they're clear or almost clear.
You know, Abby, you mentioned earlier that psoriasis can be confused with other conditions. Could you describe a patient case that illustrates this point? And it may be a little more complicated than the scales on the elbows.
Yes. So I think this is really a common point of confusion. You know, imagine a patient who's 50 years old, 20 pounds overweight, so, you know, a little heavy, and she complains of a persistent rash, you know, under her breasts and in the abdominal folds. And I think very commonly these patients are told that they have intertrigo and often treated with nystatin or another anti-yeast agent. And in fact, you know, this very much can be the presentation, like Paul was mentioning earlier, of intertriginous psoriasis. And one way that's really very helpful to tell these two apart is that Canada should have satellite lesions. So you should see little pinpoint red papules at the periphery of, you know, of a patch of yeast. In contrast, psoriasis doesn't. You really see a much more of a sharp demargination. And so I think that's a good clue. My other favorite clue is to look under the patient's underwear in between their buttock cheeks, because this is a very common location for intertriginous psoriasis to develop a plaque, and we call that the supergluteal cleft. So above the rectum, sort of aiming toward the back. And if there's involvement there, that's another indication that it may be this type of intertriginous psoriasis. So those two things are really very commonly confused. People often also will confuse it with tinea infection. Tinea cures can certainly occur, especially in the groin and the inguinal folds. There you usually see a scaly border. We don't tend to see that with intertriginous psoriasis. So that might be a way to distinguish those. And then certainly if there's the appropriate history, you might have to worry about a contact dermatitis. You know, let's say a patient were applying, a topical medication that they were allergic to the vehicle. And, for example, you could imagine they could develop a contact dermatitis in those locations as well. But I think probably the most common thing that is confusing is this intertrigo or is it psoriasis?
So, Abby, we see that this is a little more complicated patient and a little bit more of a differential. To follow up on that, how would you manage this patient?
Well, I'd probably do a couple things. First of all, I think this is somebody that I would use a low-potency topical steroid on. Remember that when skin touches skin, the absorption of those topical steroids very much is increased. So you don't want to be using your class 1 steroid in those more private areas, under the breast, in the belly fold, in the inguinal folds, you know, between the buttock cheeks. So a low-potency topical steroid is often very helpful. You know, I will tell you, as a result of the fact that often that skin gets kind of damp, it sometimes can be even more confusing because sometimes secondarily they'll develop, that kind of patient will develop a yeast infection in addition. So sometimes I'll throw in a little anti-yeast agent too, just to kind of get rid of that background possibility. And then the third thing I like to do is to use barrier creams. I think, you know, from a skin cell's point of view, those kind of areas, the around the groin, around the rectum, stool is very acidic, so is urine. From a skin cell's point of view, that's a pretty harsh world for those cells to be living in. And I think sometimes these patients have so much trouble because they do what we call kebnerization, which means that the skin, anywhere the skin is irritated, it develops more psoriasis. And those barrier creams can be hugely helpful at just protecting that skin, so therefore they don't tend to break out as often. And, you know, honestly, it's nothing more fancy than the same kind of thing you would recommend to a new mom who just has a baby. So often I'll tell people to go get whatever your favorite zinc oxide is, you know, I'll have them use that. When that fails, and once in a while it does, sometimes I'll use the excimer laser to treat just that localized area, you know, under those, maybe in the supergluteal cleft or maybe under the breasts, and that can be very, very helpful. And when those things don't work, and occasionally they don't, then sometimes it really warrants systemic therapy. You know, I've had patients, it's heartbreaking, you know, in my office, you know, tell me how they can't sit, they can barely use the bathroom, they certainly can't have sexual relations with their partners. You know, so I think in those most severe examples, systemic therapy sometimes becomes very appropriate.
So we're mentioning now systemic agents, and I'd like to get into that topic a little further. Paul, can you tell us how these agents can be used for treating psoriasis from the viewpoint of the primary care provider, which a lot of our listeners are?
Yeah, sure. So with a patient that has extensive skin disease, you know, somebody has more than 5% of their body involved, and topicals are just not the right thing. We're certainly not going to use oral steroids. You want to use something systemic. And I think that a primary care provider should feel relatively comfortable, at least with methotrexate. I mean, it's been around for, 60 years or so. It's pretty effective. There's a couple other medications, cyclosporine, but it is something which we can consider using systemically for extensive cases. It's also not approved in children. And I've seen it used primarily to suppress a crisis, like as a bridge therapy. I ever have a patient with it, a dermatologist has been involved. Escitretin, it's an oral retinoid as well. It's usually combined with phototherapy from what I've seen. The one other medication, apremilast, I do think it's a pretty good idea for primary care providers to know how to use it. But anything after that, I think I'm going to have to defer to somebody like Abby. In fact, you know, when it does come to systemic problems, or more specifically, when the psoriasis is more extensive and there's joint involvement, I think it's really important for a family doctor, primary care provider, to get a dermatologist involved.
So, Abby, would you like to take us a little further into the role of biologic and systemic agents in treating psoriasis?
Sure. And let me start by saying I use all of the agents that Paul has used as well. So, because they all have their place in the, you know, psoriasis toolkit, as I like to think of it. You know, but the last 10 to 15 years have been nothing short of miraculous in the development of new agents in the field of psoriasis. We started with the TNF inhibitors, then subsequently IL-12/23 agents were developed. And then in the last little while, we've had the development of the IL-17 inhibitors and the IL-23 inhibitors. And I think, you know, it's been one of these wonderful moments in medicine and science where, you know, where with each new drug, we learned, we came to understand more and more about that immune system and how it really was functioning in our disease. And so, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we used to think that psoriasis was a Th1-mediated disease, but now we understand that it's actually most dominantly a Th17-mediated disease. So I think, you know, and we see that bearing out in some of these drugs. So the TNF inhibitors can be hugely helpful for patients, and they have that wonderful advantage that they can be effective in both skin and joint disease. So, you know, for the patient who has both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, that can really be a boon to be able to take one medicine and have it work for both conditions. The IL-17 inhibitors, they too kind of work in both conditions. And many people have really thought, you know, they really are even more, you know, precise in terms of what they're targeting. And in keeping with that, we've seen success rates at getting people clear, you know, with the IL-17 agents that really are nothing short of miraculous. So we have taken, you know, if TNF inhibitors really, you know, were our great beginning, then the IL-17 agents took it, you know, one step further. The IL-12/23 inhibitor is a medication that probably is working primarily through the IL-23 inhibition, because IL-23 interacts with IL-17. And so basically, and the same is true for the IL-23 inhibitors alone. And we see really excellent response here of the skin. You know, the joints respond, but not quite as well as they do with the TNF inhibitors. But what's really great about these drugs is that they can be administered much more intermittently. So, for example, with the IL-12/23 inhibitors, they're given every 12 weeks. You know, that means patients are taking a shot, you know, once a quarter. I mean, really nothing, you know, patients have said to me, you know, actually for the first time I can forget I have psoriasis. So I think, you know, the TNF inhibitors, you know, definitely have a role, and they especially have a role when, you know, when joints are involved. But you can see where we've gotten ever more surgical in our strike, if you will, against what we believe to be the driver of psoriasis over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. So it's really nothing short of revolutionary. So I think, you know, if you ask me, how do I choose? Because, you know, we have now many agents and various different mechanisms of action. You know, very commonly it depends on what the patient's other comorbidities are. You know, so for example, as I was saying earlier, if somebody has joint disease, then I might go with my TNF inhibitor or my IL-17 agent. If they have just a little bit, you know, that where I don't need the same amount of power, you know, the IL-12/23 probably will be adequate. On the other hand, if I have somebody who's needle phobic, or, you know, somebody who's away at college and, you know, those kinds of things, you know, boy, that being able to administer something once a quarter is pretty sweet. So, you know, very commonly it's what's the rest of the component in that patient's concerns that drives what decision we make.
So, Paul, going back to the primary care office, how do you delineate limited or extensive psoriasis?
I think that one of the best ways is, you know, about mild psoriasis, moderate psoriasis, and severe, with mild psoriasis being less than 3% of body surface, maybe something like maybe just the knees involved or something, or just the elbows. Moderate psoriasis being, let's say, larger scales and maybe on both knees and elbows, and then severe psoriasis, anything more than that. So moderate being 3 to 10%, and severe psoriasis being more than 10%.
For those just tuning in, this is CME on ReachMD. I'm Dr. Shira Johnson, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Paul Dogramji and Dr. Abby Van Voorhees about diagnosing and managing psoriasis in the primary care office for the dermatologist or the primary care physician. So now that we have this information on the treatment of psoriasis, let's turn to our next patient case. Paul, can you give us this patient's background?
All right, let's go to a more difficult case. So I'm going to present to you a 58-year-old woman that comes to my practice. She's had psoriasis for about 20 years or so. It's been a moderate degree, and she hasn't been in my practice that long, but she comes in saying that she's been treated with topical steroids only. She covers up a large portion of her body just so that people don't see it. And, you know, she's kind of lived with it and it figured that that's the only thing that anybody can do. She has some comorbidities. She has COPD from smoking. She has hypertension, hyperlipidemia. And for those two conditions, she is on oral medications, atorvastatin and lisinopril. So she's coming in for worsening joint pain that's been going for about a year or so. And she says that her joints and her fingers, especially, you know, on the right hand, the DIPs and primarily the DIPs, but some PIPs are affected in some of the fingers, but now also both of her knees. She's really stiff when she gets up in the morning in those joints. It takes a half an hour to an hour or so until some of the stiffness lets up. So she's been recommended, you know, by maybe some friends, maybe even other doctors to use systemic treatments for psoriasis as well as maybe development of arthritis, but she's not been really accepting. And now she's coming and saying, maybe I should consider it. So this is my case.
So from your point of view, with this patient with extensive disease, Paul, how would you begin to treat this patient?
Well, you know, one of the things that Abby mentioned earlier, and I love this idea about the treat to target, and what is our goal in this patient? And I think that she said earlier, and it's just to make the skin free and clear, and let's say less than 1% of her skin involved. I think it's a pretty darn good goal. So if the acceptable response, it's not been met, you know, nothing is really getting, then your patient may not go with that treatment, but maybe another treatment as well. And there are some others that we've mentioned. Now, again, I think the critical thing, though, here is this patient is considering systemic treatment. We've already talked about that, and I think I would have no problems putting this patient on methotrexate. But Abby, you said earlier that it may be good for the skin, but it may not necessarily be good for the joint. So let me turn it to you, Abby. What would you do with a patient like this from the start?
So, you know, what's interesting about methotrexate is that it makes the joints feel better. So patients are less symptomatic. But to date, it does not seem like it reverses the bone generation that can occur in psoriatic arthritis. And so for that reason, this would probably, you know, if I really thought the patient had true psoriatic arthritis, then this would be somebody that I might push to put on one of the biologic agents first. And here, I might be looking at one of the drugs where I really think I have some power in the psoriatic arthritis area. So I might be thinking about one of the TNF inhibitors or one of the IL-17 agents. So I think that's probably, you know, you never can say for sure because sometimes patients respond to one drug more than another. And you know, you could think about a apremilast for a patient like this. And certainly our IL-12/23s can work quite effectively. But I think if you wanted to go with the highest yield, you know, probably the TNF inhibitors or the IL-17 inhibitors would be the way to go.
Abby, can I ask you a question? You said about, interestingly, you said, if I thought this patient had psoriatic arthritis, there's a psoriasis epidemiology screening tool. Is that a good thing for us to use?
Yeah, you know, we're really working on it. Yes, there are screening tools, and there are several of them, and they really do seem to aid clinicians in trying to determine whether the patient truly has psoriatic arthritis or whether they may just have, you know, more garden variety osteoarthritis, or sometimes, you know, patients come in and they really have fibromyalgia and everything sort of aches a little bit. So distinguishing, you know, that from the patient who truly has psoriatic arthritis, that can be hugely helpful. One of the things which this patient had, which I find at least is a helpful clue, is that their joint pain lasted a long time. So what's very characteristic about psoriatic arthritis is that the pain occurs at rest. So patients will describe that first thing in the morning that they can't move. You know, they can't get out of bed. And they'll often say it will last about an hour. So patients who have pain at the point of rest that lasts for 30 to 60 minutes, you better have your antenna up that this is somebody who should be evaluated. I think sometimes if I think patients are just, answering the questions thinking I know what I want to hear, what I do is I ask them what happens if they get in a long, go for a long car drive. You know, how does it feel to get out of the car at that rest stop? And patients with true psoriatic arthritis will tell you that, it's near impossible. They can't walk. So it's that very classic pain after rest that is very typical of psoriatic arthritis pain.
And if I'm concerned about psoriatic arthritis, Abby, I'm really concerned about permanent joint destruction, because once that happens, you can't go back on it.
That's exactly right. And, with some of these biologic agents, that destruction appears to be prevented. So that's huge, because obviously in the old days, patients had crippling arthritis, and now we shouldn't be seeing that any longer.
Abby, can you say a few words to us about, if you're using a biologic agent, about the time frame for response and also the safety?
Sure. So generally when I start a biologic agent, as Paul was saying, usually patients get a nice response usually after about 12 weeks. So usually after about 3 months. But, if it's not completely to my satisfaction, where maybe they've had a partial response, but it's not as good as we'd like to see, people can continue to improve up to about 6 months. But at that six-month point, if they're still not achieving those targets, that clear, almost clear, that we're really striving for, then it's time to revisit the equation. And it might be simple enough, like adding a topical steroid, to the mix just to try to push a stubborn plaque along. Or it might be, on the other extreme, it might be changing biologic drugs. So it really varies depending on the unique situation of that patient. I think, with all of these biologic drugs, the safety profiles look more similar than they look different. The main risk is the risk of infection. And that, that is clear. Most of the time those infections are minor, colds and that sort of thing, but occasionally those infections can be serious and even have been life-threatening. So that certainly is the risk of these biologics across the board. The TNF inhibitors, have a little stronger risk than the others of TB reactivation. It has to do with the TNF, what TNF does in the lungs, for a tuberculin. But I think in general, it's recommended that all patients on all of these biologic agents be screened for tuberculosis. The IL-17 agents, we know, can increase people's risk of candida infections. So that's unique to that class of drugs. Those infections, though, generally are minor enough that we can continue treatment and just use a topical anti-yeast agent and achieve, and bring that back under control. So those are the main safety risks. So infections are the thing that I spend most of my time talking to patients about.
So, Paul, can you say a few words on when would you refer to dermatology? And then can each of you address any suggestions you have for optimizing the shared management of patients with psoriasis between primary care and dermatology, especially the complicated patients?
Sure. This patient has extensive disease, longstanding disease. She's really been upset by the condition of her skin. She's almost even had sort of a dejected attitude towards it. But also now there's joint disease going on, probably psoriatic arthritis. I'm worried about joint destruction. So I think it's important for me to co-manage this case with a dermatologist. I probably would call my dermatologist consult, and I would discuss the case with him or her. But in doing so and in thinking ahead that maybe a systemic medication is going to be used, I'm obviously going to look for infection and infection prevention, like vaccination, also doing some blood tests, background blood tests, in preparation for the patient to be on a systemic medication. I'd also talk to the patient at this point about comorbidities, and as we've discussed earlier, this is a systemic problem, and I want to make sure that the patient and I and the dermatologist all aware that we're a team effort here to look for these comorbid conditions, either screen for them, identify them, manage them, and mitigate their issues. But yeah, this patient is most likely going to be seen by a dermatologist and co-managed with me.
And Abby, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. What I want to stress is the fact that, we used to think of psoriasis as just, and we used to say, quote, just skin disease. But now we know that it is associated with systemic inflammation. Patients with psoriasis have a much higher frequency of developing the metabolic syndrome, and they have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease in addition to also having an increased risk for psoriatic arthritis. And so, you know, for all of my patients with psoriasis, I need desperate help from patients' primary doctors to work with me to try to get these patients to lose weight. We, you know, they're very commonly overweight, and we know that that overweight state increases the severity of their disease. So if they could somehow lose that weight, we know it makes them, you know, more responsive. Even if they need medications, they respond better to them. They have all the component parts of the metabolic syndrome. They have hypertension and elevated lipids, as well as that increased weight. So all of those things need to be addressed and worked on and prevented if they haven't developed it yet, or modified and worked on if they have developed it. And, that, you know, in fact, I like sending even my patients who just have psoriasis alone and they don't have any sign of this, I like sending to my primary care doctor. You know, the way I look at it is, you know, psoriasis is the disease of the young. It most often starts when people are in their late teens, early 20s. So if we know that these people are at increased risk for developing the metabolic syndrome and an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, we have a whole lifetime in these individuals to work to try to mitigate some of those risks. And so I really think it's very critical. And often they'll seek out dermatologist care because they see the skin. And I find very commonly they don't have a primary doctor. And so I'm often the one saying, hey, no, you've got to plug in. And so I think that's hugely important that we work together and on these patients. And the other thing is, you know, these patients have a much higher frequency of smoking, and that also correlates with their disease becoming more severe. So again, you know, strategies to work on these kind of better health habits are really so critical for these patients. And hopefully, as we, you know, mitigate some of these risks, if we can catch them early and mitigate them, you know, hopefully we won't find that psoriasis patients, you know, have a 5-year shorter life expectancy than patients who don't have psoriasis. So I think, as you know, I think that we have a lot of work that we can do to make a difference.
Well, we've certainly covered a lot in this discussion, but just to wrap everything up, what are the key points that you'd want our audience to remember about the diagnosis and management of psoriasis? Abby, let's start with you.
Sure. I think just is make sure to treat the skin adequately. You know, we want to look for mild deforms, look in areas, you know, the intertriginous areas to see if it's there. Patients are often shy about bringing it up, but it certainly is very troubling to them when it's there. And think about using systemic agents when it's more expensive or more persnickety. I think know how to use the biologic agents and monitor those patients for signs of infection. And I think if you don't feel comfortable using systemic agents, then send them to somebody who does, because both in terms of impacting these patients' mental health as well as their joint health as well as their cardiovascular health, we can really make very significant differences. So I think, you know, treating these patients adequately is really very, very important.
And what about you, Paul? What are the key takeaways that you'd like to share with primary care providers?
Yeah, in primary care, the most important thing is knowing. You got to know this disease. You got to know this condition. Know what a psoriasis looks like. And know that plaque psoriasis isn't the only way. There are several other forms. And know your dermatologist in the area and consult with them and discuss it. And also know that, again, as Abby said and I've said earlier, this is a systemic problem. It's an inflammatory systemic problem. And as such, so number one, you're going to have to be involved in management of the disorder. If it's just milder forms, you need to know what medications to use, whether it's the steroids or the non-steroids, in the topical form. In the more extensive types, you need to know some of the systemic medications, and you may be comfortable using some of the systemic ones, but again, consult with a dermatologist and co-manage. But there are two other things that primary care providers also need to know when psoriasis is involved, and that's early detection and prevention. Early detection means that there are so many comorbidities associated with this. And as Abby said earlier, you know, obesity, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, even depression, by the way, goes on with these patients. 60% of patients with psoriasis also have depression. It's important to follow these patients. All my psoriasis patients come in once a year for an annual checkup for me to see how they're doing in general and also to look at their psoriatic condition and how it's being managed and emphasize the proper treatment there. So early detection and, as far as prevention goes, vaccination. That's a very important point. In fact, before I send a patient to a dermatologist, I might find myself making sure that their vaccines are all up to date and ensuring and encouraging that to happen. These are all very important things for a primary care provider to know, that they need to co-manage the condition, inform your dermatologist what you're doing. One other thing, by the way, and that's infection. I tell all my patients with psoriasis, because of their immunologic problems that are involved here, if you get any infection, any symptom of infection, call me earlier than later. Don't let this go, because it can run away with itself much quicker. Let me be really involved in your care earlier when it comes to infection. These are important points for our primary care audience to know.
Those were all great points to take with us moving forward. And with that, I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Paul Dograme and Dr. Abby Van Voorhees, for joining me to discuss the diagnosis and management of psoriasis in the primary care setting. It was really great having you both on the show.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
The preceding activity was sponsored by the France Foundation and funded by an educational grant from Novartis. To receive your free CME credit, please be sure to complete the post-test and evaluation by visiting reachmd.com/CME. This is CME on ReachMD. Be part of the knowledge.